Hi, my name's Beck, and I'll be reading Psalm 121 tonight, and that can be found on page 429 of the Pew Bibles. I lift up my eyes to the mountains. Where does my help come from? My help comes from the Lord, the maker of heaven and earth. He will not let your foot slip. He who watches over you will not slumber. Indeed, he who watches over Israel will neither slumber nor sleep. The Lord watches over you. The Lord is your shade at your right hand. The sun will not harm you by day, nor the moon by night. The Lord will keep you from all harm. He will watch over your life. The Lord will watch over your coming and going, both now and forevermore.
My name's Tom, if I haven't met you before. 6 p.m. is the service that I keep a particular eye on, and we are indeed going to talk about sleep tonight. I would love to know what time you got up this morning. I'd also love to know what time you went to bed last night. I have a little 11-month-old girl, and I think her language abilities are pretty limited, but she did work out that I'm preaching on sleep today, and she did decide to wake up at 5:30 just to make it a real worked example. So we're going to see if this sermon comes out in a straight line or not. You can be the judge. Hey, why are we doing this sermon? Elliot was exactly right to say that usually our pattern and our passion at this church is to pick a book of the Bible, work through it kind of chapter by chapter, letting God's agenda set our agenda for tonight. But there's also value in picking topics and thinking biblically, hey, what does the Bible have to say? What is God's wisdom to me on this particular topic? So all of life is worth studying through the lens of the scriptures. That's one of the reasons we're doing tonight. The other reason that we're doing tonight is I do genuinely have an area of pastoral concern for you. I've been here for about a year and a bit now, looking after this service, and I have observed that there are many of us who maybe haven't connected up the dots on God and sleep. And actually, you're choosing to not enjoy the sleep that God has for you. But I think as a result of tonight's sermon, I hope that your understanding and your appreciation of sleep will increase. That's where I'm going. Let me give you a worked example. This is Henry Kozlowski's sleep data. He's got one of those apps that tracks what's going on. So you can see here, March 26th to April 1st, and you're getting just enough sleep to allow your body to recover. Well done, Henry, 81%. But April 2 till April 8, your sleep performance over this period is lower than your recent average, which makes it less likely for your body to recover. Naps can prevent sleep. He said, take a nap. Your app said, take a nap. And for many of us, this is the story, right? 1 week, good week, I slept lots, it was great. Next week, horrible week, I hardly slept at all. And I imagine that if we all had watches that were all tracking our stuff, this would actually be a pretty regular story. So we're going to talk about sleep tonight. Let me tell you a couple of things about sleep that you could find out outside of a church, and then we'll start digging deeply into the Bible. Many of you, if you're scooting around on YouTube or whatever, you'll come across this guy as he talks about sleep. This is Huberman. He's one of the bros going around on YouTube. He's going to tell you that as soon as you wake up, you need to go look not directly at the sun, but next to the sun. That's going to help you wake up. It's going to set your circadian rhythms. You can get all this kind of stuff on YouTube. If you scoot around a little bit further and you do some Googling, maybe even look up research papers, you might get a list of things that looks a little bit like this when it comes to sleep. You should probably do some exercise. It's going to help you sleep. You should get your screens out of the bedroom. It'll help you sleep. Shouldn't have coffee or energy drinks after a certain point in the day. Nightcaps, having a little bit of alcohol before you go to sleep. It might help you fall asleep, but it actually affects your sleep during the rest of the night. So your net result is actually lower than if you didn't have the nightcap. Thermal shedding sounds really cool, so I thought I'd put it in there. It's like you have a shower and your body realizes that you got out of the warm shower, it got a bit cooler. Apparently that helps your body go to sleep. Lots of people have different opinions on what temperature your room should be, ideally, but you definitely don't want to be sleeping in a room that's too hot, and you want to have some kind of a wind-down routine. Does this sound like the kind of stuff that people have told you to do before? This is all just wisdom from the world about how to sleep. So with all of that as introduction, I would love, this is my structure for today, I'm just going to tell you 7 things from the Bible. By the time we get to 7, that's how you know it's over. Let's start at 1. I want to talk about oversleeping. This is a theme, particularly in the book of Proverbs. It is possible to be lazy, or really old school piece of language, to be a sluggard. Let me give you some Bible verses on that. Proverbs chapter 6, verse 9. How long will you lie there, you sluggard? When will you get up from your sleep? It is possible that you love sleep too much. Now, there's probably like 2% of the room who are in that kind of zone, but it's worth saying because it's one of the threads in the Bible. I'll give you a second verse about that. So Proverbs chapter 20, verse 13. Do not love sleep or you'll grow poor. Stay awake and you will have food to spare. It's talking there about the value of hard work. It is possible to bludge your way through life. So sometimes people, and honestly, if this is you, I resonate and I also feel sorry for you. I'd love to help you with this. Some people actually feel like there's not much purpose in their life. It's like, why would I get out of bed? At least here is comfy. Because out there are things that I don't want to do, people I don't want to talk to, or really, there's just nothing worth getting up for. I wonder if you resonate with that sentiment. If that's you, you might find yourself kind of loving sleep, ending up not really doing anything with your time at all. I'd love to help you discover the purpose that God has for your life that actually has meaningful work for you to do. So that's oversleep. Point one, we're doing 7 points. You're 1 out of 7 done already. Point two, though, is probably where the rubber hits the road for a lot of us. I want to talk about undersleep. And before I start getting stuck into you who are voluntarily undersleeping, I'd love to actually say a word to you who are undersleeping, and it's actually not your fault. You're undersleeping because you've got something that's actually not working right in your body. You have some kind of a medical diagnosis, a genuine sleep condition, and you're suffering. And honestly, you know, even if you're not in this boat, can you imagine every single night, you try to go to sleep because everyone else is going to sleep, and you know this is not going to be a good time until the sun comes up again. And your existence is punctuated by looking at the alarm clock and it says 2:30, and you think, I'm not asleep. And you look at the alarm clock and it says 3:30, and you feel like I'm going to feel horrible the next day. And a genuine existence of suffering because you're not able to sleep. If that's you, I just got a couple of things to say. And these kind of things apply as well to you, just as you think about suffering overall. It's worth recognizing that back in Genesis, first book of the Bible, Adam and Eve, there was no suffering. Adam and Eve were created in a suffering-free garden. Suffering comes into the world at the fall, very early in the book of Genesis there. And some of us are tempted to say, damn it, Adam, damn it, Eve, like you guys stuffed it up for all of us. There wouldn't be any suffering in the world if it wasn't for you guys. That's kind of true, and we inherit their nature as well, but we're sinners by nature and by choice. Can you distinguish those two things? Sinners by nature and sinners by choice. And I would venture that you and I, if we were put in Adam and Eve's position, would do exactly the same thing. The reason I venture that is because even after you've maybe been a Christian for a little while, your life is still punctuated by sin. My life is still punctuated by sin. And I think, of course, I would have done exactly what they did. And so that's when suffering comes into the world for the first time. We live in a world full of suffering. Can I just have a little sidebar here for a second? Sometimes people's biggest objection to the Christian faith is they say, I can't believe in a God because there's so much suffering around me. Can't believe in a God because I suffer so much. And I feel you, I really do. Can I just slightly tweak the way you're thinking it though? When you read the Bible, the world is pretty close to the way you would expect it to be if you're reading this thing right. You read Genesis 3 and you go, yeah, the world that I live in is fallen. And you look around and you see suffering, and you read like all the way through the New Testament, it's always talking about people who are suffering. We follow a suffering king. When you look at the Bible, you expect to see suffering. The world is the way you expect it to be if you're reading this book right. I actually think suffering confirms what's going on here in a very painful way, but it confirms what's going on here. So we get suffering, for example, the introduction of sleeplessness all the way back at the fall. We come forward to Jesus, and what's amazing about Jesus is he's not a God who's far off from our suffering, but he enters into our world, And when Jesus sees our suffering, he weeps. When he saw Lazarus, he's dead in the tomb. You know, he's got the power over the ability to raise him from the dead, and yet he still weeps. And Jesus knows what it's like to suffer. He's called a man of sorrows. So he's with us in our suffering. We've got a companion in our suffering if you turn to Jesus in your suffering. And you get all the way to the end of the Bible, to the book of Revelation. And you see that there is a world coming where there is no more suffering. When God will wipe away every tear, all mourning, all pain. There'll be no more death. I assume there'll be no more sleepless nights. And so that world is coming. And right now we are waiting patiently for that world as God gathers more people in to be saved first. So that's just a couple of words to you if you're experiencing undersleep and it's genuinely not your fault. You're having a lot of trouble because of things that are going not the way they ought to in your brain, in your body, whatever it is. We'd love to suffer with you. We'd love to pray with you. We'd love to be a community through that. Some people in the room, you're undersleeping and it's kind of not your fault at all. But here's what real, like the pastoral burden that I'm feeling for tonight's sermon is I want to talk about us who are undersleeping, and it kind of is our fault, and we're undersleeping, but we actually could change that if we clued into God and sleep. So I want to talk about undersleeping. Got at least three major reasons that there might be other ones as well, but can we explore three major reasons that you might be undersleeping because of your phone, because of your stacked life, and because you're anxious about stuff. In terms of phones, does this picture look familiar? Is this one of the reasons that you're not sleeping enough at night? People didn't used to do that 20 years. People did not get kept awake 20 years ago by these things, but we do now, and it's a part of modern life. And so if we're just going to bring a Bible lens to that, we might just need to say, hey, as I grow as a person, as I grow as a Christian, I need to exercise discipline to know that this is a thing, but it doesn't have to be a thing if I can exercise my self-discipline, put the thing away, do a proper wind down, I might be able to get some better sleep. We're undersleeping because of our phones, and self-discipline, which is part of the fruit of the Spirit, might actually help us. Some of us are undersleeping because of stacked lives. Now, you've intentionally filled your life with things, and you don't have time for sleep. Maybe you've even stacked your life with good things, and you just do not have time for the inconvenient necessity that sleep is. If that's you, I would love for you to dig deep into Psalm 127. Unless the Lord builds the house, the builders labor in vain. Unless the Lord watches over the city, the guards stand watch in vain. In vain you rise early and stay up late, toiling for food to eat. For he grants sleep to those he loves. Can I give you that last sentence again? He grants sleep to those he loves. One way you could view sleep is you could say, there's a bad thing that I have to do sometimes. If you take this verse to heart, you say, this is a thing from God. This is a gift from God. He grants it out of love. Sleep becomes a good thing. This changes the way that you think just moments before you put your head on the pillow. You say, God, thank you for this good gift. This is from you and I receive it from you. So for some of us, we're undersleeping because of our phones, simple self-discipline. Some of us, we're undersleeping because we've stacked our lives and we actually need to receive the gift of God. Some of us, we're undersleeping because we're anxious about the day to come. So real talk, I was talking to somebody and they said, yeah, the reason I don't sleep is because if there's a bad thing coming tomorrow, if I go to sleep, the bad thing happens straight away because I'm unconscious for those. But if I don't want the bad thing to come, then I can delay it by just not going to sleep. And I was like, oh, that's really real. I'm not talking about medical anxiety here. I'm talking about like the worry, just the anxiousness that all of us have. Can I point you to 1 Peter chapter 5, verses 6 and 7? There's some powerful stuff in here. And by the way, if you're not sure where you're at with all the God stuff, I imagine that there's a lot of anxiety in your life, not the medical kind, just the regular kind. I imagine there's a bunch of worry in your life. And knowing God really helps with that. 1 Peter chapter 5, humble yourselves, therefore, under God's mighty hand, that he may lift you up in due time. Cast all your anxiety on him, because he cares for you. I like that word, cast. Sometimes you see fishermen, I feel like we should call them fisher people. Fishermen, they chuck the line out into the water. They chuck the line out as far as they can. They're not chucking it to anybody in particular. They're chucking it out into the water. I feel like you kind of cast. When you're chucking a rugby ball or something, you're casting that thing. There are lots of kind of, you do a lot of casting. What I like about this language is it's kind of like chucking your anxieties, but at somebody who's meant to catch it, and that somebody is God. He's actually going to catch your anxieties. It's taking them off you and putting them onto him. And that's an okay, don't chuck your anxieties at me. Chuck your anxieties at God. He wants them. He cares for you. It's the language of a parent for a kid. That makes sense because you are God's daughter, you are God's son. See, God doesn't just care, get this, about you. He does care about you. He knows how many hairs are on your head. You're worth way more than the sparrow, a couple of Bible images. But more than that, he cares for you. He is actively engaged in the thing that's keeping you up at night worrying. He cares for you, and he invites you to chuck the thing that's worrying you at him, to cast your anxieties on him. And can I take you one level deeper into this text? That's the New International Version translation, which is excellent translation, main one we use here. There's another Bible translation called the English Standard Version, ESV, and it slightly draws out this tiny little tweak in the passage there with that word casting. So in the NIV we had read for us before, it says, do two things. Number one, humble yourself. Number two, cast your anxieties on God. In the ESV here, it's saying, do one thing, cast your anxieties on God. I stuffed it. I totally stuffed it. Do one thing, humble yourself. What does that look like? It looks like casting your anxieties on him. Actually, you can backtrack that and say, if I'm not casting my anxieties on him, it is possible that I'm not humble before him. Actually, the most humble thing you can do in the world is to chuck your anxieties at God. He wants them. He cares for you. Can I give you a couple of quotes from different people saying the same kind of thing? This is Jackie Hill Perry. She said, you're not made to carry burdens, anxieties, deadlines, etc., all by yourself. Try it and watch what it does to your peace. God cares for you, like in real life. So go ahead, throw your anxieties at his feet. This is Andrew, our magnification pastor here at church. He helps us love God more. He also helps us put together Sunday services. He says three slides of things, so get ready for it. Before giving my life to Jesus, day-to-day living felt more tense. I like that line. Next slide. Doing well in life required me to do well at school, uni, work, relationships. My life was defined by my actions, my achievements, but God worked through a series of circumstances to show it wasn't about me, that I wasn't in control. This was unexpectedly comforting. Third slide. Knowing that there is someone looking after the bigger picture provides assurance that while I have an important part to play, it's not all up to me. It's never expected that I will achieve things through my own strength. Can I give you Steph as well? For me, trusting in God means I can cast all of my anxieties and worries of the day and tomorrow on him, knowing he is in control and I can rest and sleep in the peace and assurance he gives each day. And with all of that in mind, you can come to something like Psalm chapter 4, verse 8, and this can become yours as well. In peace, I will lie down and sleep. For you alone, Lord, make me dwell in safety. It's a beautiful prayer. If you're worried that we've only done two out of our seven things, they get faster from here. We've talked about oversleep. We've talked about undersleep. Third thing I'd love to show you from the Bible is that humans sleep and God doesn't. It is hardwired into the way that God made you to be a sleeping person. Something like one third of your life you will sleep through, and that is okay. God made. He could have made you to need 2 hours, just a quick little battery pack or something. He could have made you like a koala and you need like 20 hours or whatever it is. He made us to be something like 1/3 of our lives we sleep through. And embracing that is just a part of embracing your humanity. See, contrast that with Psalm 121, which is what we had read for us before I jumped up. It says, "He who watches over Israel will neither slumber nor sleep." God doesn't sleep, and that's why you can. You want to chuck your anxieties at God? You need a God who is always awake and always able to do something about it. If God sleeps, then there are moments when everything's going to chaos, but there's not. God is in control all the time. He is the creator. He doesn't need sleep. We are the creation. We do need sleep. We're just embracing what it is to be made by God the way that he made us. There was an old school British preacher called Charles Haddon Spurgeon, beautiful beard. He said, "God gave us sleep to remind us that we are not him." Less beautiful beard, Josh Hayward, he says this, "Knowing God is God and I am not means I get to sleep knowing the world will keep turning while I am clocked out. God's work to see people know Jesus continues with or without me, so I get to humbly rest in his good care." God does not sleep, you do. And that's a good way around. This is why it's so crazy, point four, that Jesus slept. Think about this for a second. Jesus, second member of the Trinity, has no birthday. Always was. Never slept. Wasn't a thing. He did. Sometime around 0 AD, give or take a couple of years, steps into human history, takes on humanity, becomes the God-man, he takes on the limitations of what it is to be a human, and for the very first time ever, the second member of the Godhead sleeps as a little baby. And he continues to sleep, just like you and I, for the rest of his earthly life. John chapter 4 talks about how he was going on a long walk, he got tired. That's crazy for the Godhead to get tired. He stepped into our existence. There's another story where he's like sleeping on a boat and everyone's like, wait, he's resting in the Father's love. He's so confident in God being in control of everything that he can do that. It's crazy to think that Jesus gets what it's like. The God of the universe gets what it's like, not just to make somebody who sleeps, but gets what it's like to sleep. And I assume every now and then had a sleepless night or two. There's one or two of them actually recorded for us in the Gospels. And Jesus himself knows what it's like to sleep. So we've done 4 out of 7. We've talked about oversleeping on purpose. We've talked about undersleeping. We've talked about how God does not sleep. We've talked about how Jesus does sleep. I've got 3 more points. And this next one is a little bit of a tangent. It's a little bit sideways. It's a little bit serious, actually. It's this phrase that you pick up as you walk through the New Testament. You can't get away from the idea that the Bible talks about the death of a Christian a little bit like sleep, by which we mean an unconscious pause from which you one day wake up. If you're a normal person who lives in this part of Sydney, I imagine that somewhere deep inside your decision-making matrix is the basic belief that people get born, they live for a bit, and then they take one of two options. Option one, they get cremated. Option two, they get buried in a box and they become worm food. Those are kind of your two options at the end of the day. If you're a Christian, you believe that there are two options as well, but very different two options. We believe that everyone stands before the judgment seat of God one day, and some will be judged to eternal life, and others will actually have a horrible experience on that day and beyond. But here's the thing. The Bible talks about the death of a Christian as falling asleep. I wonder if you've attended a funeral recently. Horrible things. Think about this application point from 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verse 13. We can skip forward on that one. We'll go 1 Thessalonians. It says, "We do not want you to be uninformed about those who sleep in death, so that you do not grieve like the rest of mankind who have no hope. If you think that the end of life is cremation or box, there is no cause for hope. And actually, if you're being intellectually honest, then a funeral is a horrific moment where you stare that conclusion in the face. If you're a Christian, though, you have hope beyond the grave. Not hope like I hope it's sunny tomorrow, but you have hope like a confident expectation of the future. And you do not have to grieve like the rest of people." Verse 14, next verse. "For we believe that Jesus died and rose again, and so we believe that God will bring with Jesus those who have fallen asleep in him." This means that when a Christian person who you love dies, it is not just a nice thing to say, oh, you'll see them again one day in heaven. That is a true thing to say. Because they will be raised just as Jesus was raised. He was the first fruits of them being raised. And they will be with you in the new heavens and the new earth. And it will be like they've woken up from a very deep sleep, just a pause on their conscious existence before one day we actually do get to that new heavens and that new earth. Sleep is kind of like death. Death is kind of like sleep. That's the fifth thing if we're reading our Bibles with the lens of sleep on. Can I give you two more things as we close it out? They'll be less heavy, but maybe these ones are less like Bible verses and more somebody's taken a step of reasoning and a step of logic to apply sleep to your life. So number six, I want to talk about sleep and holiness. This is a guy from North America, Don Carson. He said this. I wonder what you think about it. "If you are among those who become nasty, cynical, or even full of doubt when you're missing your sleep, you are morally obligated to try to get the sleep you need." Now, that's not the Bible, so you can accept or reject that. That's okay. But it's worth thinking about for a second, isn't it? Bunch of you guys, absolute heroes, have made it to church tonight after you've been away on a kids and youth training weekend. I imagine that a bunch of you guys stayed up pretty late, you're feeling pretty tired. I also imagine that in the moment between getting home and coming here tonight, or getting home and tuning into the live stream tonight, that you didn't treat somebody particularly well. People in your house, you kind of get out of the way, you're in the way of the fridge, whatever it is. I do that. I imagine you did that too. If that's you, and you notice that there is a correlation between how tired you are and how loving you are, if you notice that there's a correlation between when I'm tired, my self-control goes down and my sin slips out even more than usual, then it might be worth considering increasing your sleep. That might be a thing that God would actually encourage you to do. And if you're in the language of Don Carson, you might say that you're morally obligated to do it. But I'll let you decide what you think about that one. Here's what Lockie said. Lockie said, "Sleep is so critical for me to recharge and have the energy to serve the Lord in every waking hour. Without sleep, not only am I tired, but I just can't serve the Lord as well as I can when rested." We've done 6 points. Let me give you the seventh. This one's kind of similar. It's about perspective and doubt. It's from another North American guy called John Piper. He says this. "It is irrational that my future should look bleaker when I get 4 or 5 hours sleep several nights in a row. But that is irrelevant. Those are the facts. And I must live within the limits of facts. I commend sufficient sleep to you for the sake of your proper assessment of God and his promises." If that didn't make any sense to you, can I try and translate that directly into our world? We're just moving into the darker part of the year. And I don't know if you believe this or not, there is a tangible correlation between the number of people who ditch the faith and the amount of waking sunlight hours that there are. There is a tangible correlation between how many people show up to church and how many hours of sunlight there are in the day. And as the year goes on, people get more and more tired. And would you believe it, as the year goes on, more and more people fall away from faith, increase their doubt, lose their zeal for God, whatever it is. You get to term four, the sun comes back out again. And everyone's like, oh, I love God so much. And it's like, oh, wow, we really are embodied beings, aren't we? And honestly, I'm preaching to myself at this point. This is exactly what I do. You get me in like June, July, and I'm just going to be like miserable. And it's purely because of the sun. And it's purely because of my lack of sleep and my tiredness. Now, recognizing that about yourself is so helpful. Now, it's very possible that in a couple of months' time, you will have real things go on in life that cause you to question the goodness of God. It is also possible that a part of that mixture and that soup is your embodied experience of not having slept enough recently. Your perspective changes when you haven't slept enough. And honestly, I felt this morning. I was sitting up the back in the morning service where Ella is sitting, and I was like, I'm really not feeling it. And I was like, why am I not feeling it? Like, Elliot's sermon is really great. The band is exactly the same band from this morning. And I was like, you know why I'm not feeling it? Because Ava woke me up at 5:30 this morning. Like, that is the reason that my spiritual temperature check didn't feel great this morning, is literally just because I had a couple less hours sleep than I was hoping to. Recognizing that in yourself is so powerful. There is a relationship between your sleep and how you feel subjectively about God. And so with Piper, can I say, I commend sufficient sleep to you for the sake of your proper assessment of God and his promises. Can we draw this one to a close? Seven things from the Bible about sleep. First one, it is possible to oversleep. Secondly, most of us are undersleeping and we're choosing to do it. Third thing, though, to actually choose to sleep is an embracing of the way that God made us. He chose to make us this way. And so it is crazy that the God who never sleeps stepped into our world and knows exactly what it's like to be a human and knows what it's like to sleep. When we go to a funeral, we can have a different perspective from those around us who have no hope. It is possible that actually you can pursue better holiness by paying a little bit of attention to your sleep as well as other factors. Same thing with your doubt and how much you're feeling the vibes on God that day. It might be connected to the way that you're sleeping. Do you guys want to see how Henry's sleep score increased? Final slide. How's this? Can we have a round of applause for Henry? And that had nothing to do with the sermon because it all happened beforehand. So well done, Henry. Let me pray. God, thank you so much for the gift of sleep. God, we recognize that you made us humans and we're not like you and you're not like us. We ask that we'd be people who sit within your design and love being the way that you made us. We pray that for those of us who are able, that we would just receive the gift of sleep. For those of us who are struggling with that medically, we ask that you would bring great doctors. We ask that you bring healing as well. God, we ask that you'd help us to cast our anxieties on you and to find peace. We ask for people who would actually find that degree of peace by connecting to you for the very first time. And I ask that this would be a church where that happens heaps. God, you're so good to us even when we're not good to you. And everyone who agreed said...